This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, you're with Caroline and Ezra, and this evening we're going to be talking about nuclear power. Now, nuclear power is gaining ground as a contender in the energy markets, its pros being clean energy, relatively low operating costs, and the capacity to meet higher energy demands than that of alternatives like solar or wind power.
Yeah, so public perception, however, took a massive hit when the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power station was inundated by a huge tidal wave that crashed into the coast of Japan, causing a meltdown in three of its nuclear reactors.
The devastation of the incident is still fresh in our collective memory, but how much damage did the tsunami-hit nuclear power plant cause? Was the nuclear fallout really that bad?
And I think at the end of the day, what is nuclear power anyway? And more pertinent to us, what would a nuclear program mean for Malaysia?
And here to break it down for us, we have two experienced engineers and academicians in the studio. We have Tan Sri Dr. Haji Ahmad Zaidi Laidin, as well as Lal Chan Gulabrai. Thank you very much for joining us. Let's start very, quite simply, what is nuclear power?
Well, as far as nuclear power is concerned, it itself is not new. The only difference is that it is used to generate steam. Now, there are lots of ways of generating steam. It can be from oil, from coal, from gas. And nuclear power is actually from uranium fission and so on. But the actual driving of the turbines is from superheated steam, just like any other steam power plants. So in that sense, that's what it is.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
Right. You know, there are terms that are thrown around quite a bit, especially when we talk about nuclear. Can you explain to us the concept of energy density?
Well, energy density is basically how much energy you get out of a unit of input. Now, nuclear is the most energy dense in terms of energy generation. On the other hand, solar photovoltaic is probably the opposite end of it, the least energy dense. What is important here is that the energy that is needed is not just in terms of megawatts of power, but gigawatt hours of energy, because consumers need energy for usage, not just the power. And this is where there's some misconception over the potential of solar photovoltaic being able to displace other base load plant such as nuclear, coal, gas, and so on.
So it sounds like there are advantages that nuclear has over other fuels?
Definitely there are advantages. There are also disadvantages. And in power generation, for electricity supply particularly, the utilities and the consumers need to have a mix of all types of technologies to satisfy the variable demand of consumers as needed. Because energy is not stored. You just generate as much as consumers need, plus whatever is needed to supply the losses to satisfy the customer's demand.
Right. I suppose we can explore what Malaysia's portfolio is in that respect in just a bit. Can you tell us about the advantages that nuclear has over other fuels?
Well, I like to try that. Because the nuclear, as far as the advantage is concerned, economically, it is still the cheapest way to produce electricity. But of course, the cost variable in the sense that we are looking at a whole lot of investment from beginning to end, and the whole lot of investment in terms of techniques and expertise that's required, much, much more than normal power plants, and the regulatory aspects. That you have to have much more well-trained people to be even ensuring the quality and the technology is properly maintained. I think this is the critical thing. Further are the advantages is that it is carbon dioxide free. You know, that is a big selling point, if you like. It's green, you talk about green. But of course there are other disadvantages, which I think I'll leave my colleague to talk about.
Is it the most green out of all the other energies that we've been speaking about?
I don't think it can be said to be the most green. It is low carbon, but it is low carbon as far as generation of electricity or energy. But in terms of mining, transport and others, there is emissions of carbons. So to say it's carbon-free is not correct. But it is correct to say it's low carbon. Similarly, photovoltaics and biomass, wind, hydro are also low carbon emission forms of generation. What I would like to say here is that nuclear power is just one form of primary energy that is needed to generate electricity. The electricity that comes out at the end is no different from electricity from any other sources.
Absolutely. Can you give us some idea on how nuclear power technologies have evolved over time?
I like to quote India here, because India started out with their first nuclear plant. It was in the era of Nehru, the first prime minister, and he said that India, in spite of all the poverty and so on, should have nuclear power. And what happens? Well, it took several generations after him, of course, but the idea of establishing the nuclear plant in India was not just a direct thing about energy. It was actually bringing up technology to India, precision engineering in India. And as a result of bringing over the technology from Canada, I think in that case, the first nuclear power plant in India, they succeeded in improving the level of precision engineering to the extent that they can produce jet engines themselves. So you see, there is no real commonality between nuclear and jet engines, but you see the spin-offs of having the expertise that is required to develop a nuclear power plant. So this is the sort of thing that perhaps a lot of people do not realize, the kinds of spin-offs in technology that can occur once you go for nuclear.
I guess the discussion almost always focuses on the more grim imagery associated with nuclear power. And why has that taken place over the past few decades? That seems to be the overriding imagery that people have of nuclear energy.
Well, I think it is the drama, if you like,
right.
When things go wrong. You know, it is extraordinary when you see, we're talking about Chernobyl and the number of people. The actual number of deaths is not that colossal, but the actual amount of evacuation and all sorts of other things, and impacting not only in Chernobyl, but also around right up to as far as Sweden and Greenland, because the wind blows whatever radioactive things that come out from Chernobyl right across throughout Europe and even in the Middle East. So, yes, it has got that sort of awareness. And even in Fukushima, for instance, fishermen were wondering, you know, whether the fish that they catch are now going to be also radioactive and what have you. So I think when things go wrong, that becomes the sort of, excitement that people are thinking about. But I feel that from the Academy of Sciences Malaysia, we are looking well beyond just that. We are looking at all the other potential and possibilities of nuclear.
Well, we'll ask you more about Chernobyl and Fukushima right after this. In the studio with us is Tan Sri, Dr. Haji Ahmad Zaidi Laidin, as well as Lalchan Gulabrai. Both are from Academy of Science Malaysia. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9. It's the evening edition. You're with Caroline and Ezra. In the studio with us is Tan Sri, Dr. Haji Ahmad Zaidi Laidin, as well as Lalchan Gulabrai. Both are from Academy of Science Malaysia, experienced engineers and academics, to talk to us about Malaysia going nuclear, but of course talking specifically about going nuclear energy. And we were speaking earlier before about the incidents of Chernobyl and Fukushima. How does technology from the days of Chernobyl differ from the technology of today?
Well, actually, Chernobyl itself was different from the first generation of the nuclear power plant. And I had a chance to visit the first nuclear power plant in England, the real power plant, because the rest were experimental. Yeah. So the first power plant was in a place called the Hall. And they finished in 1956, I think. And when they did that, of course, it was big news. It was first generation. And there were a lot of things that are still not going right, and the things that they had to improve and so on. So it is, although already an operational power plant, it is actually still experimental in that sense, because there's still a lot of learning that is taking place. So up to now, we have something like 435 power plants all over the world. So you're not talking about one anymore. And each of them has got the different generations and improvements. I think we are on the fourth generation already. And each one generation is another step up, you know, from the previous one. And therefore, the kinds of nuclear power plants change. So Chernobyl, because it comes under a much earlier generation of power plant. So when there was some power plant in Le Bourget in France, which was so automated that the people got worried because there's no means of override, human override. So they then have to recreate and re-engineer and say, look, where can we put human interface in order not to make this to be completely robot-driven, if you like. So there was this swing of technology, and how much to go automated, how much to have human interface. And all the time, we always blame the human for making mistakes.
But have we reached a sweet spot yet?
Not yet. But I believe that after 400-odd power plants, a lot of knowledge has come in and shared. And I think even in Japan, for instance, when they talk about Fukushima, but a lot of people forget that Japan introduced total quality control. The TQC technology, it is actually management technology, but it helped improve the safety of nuclear power plants all around the world. So from Japan, they brought it to the United States, because United States had a lot of problems. Remember Three Mile Island? It's the United States. I'm not sure whether you realize, but two-thirds of accidents actually occurred in the United States. But they are smaller ones. They are not this 7-degree, things like you have in Chernobyl and Fukushima.
And so Lau, maybe you can give listeners an idea as to what happened with the disasters like Chernobyl and Fukushima, and what exactly went wrong?
The consensus has been that Chernobyl accident was sort of a disaster waiting to happen. And unfortunately, it was coupled with human error in terms of activities that were supposed to be done were not done according to the so-called SOPs, standard operating procedures. This resulted in a meltdown, which was catastrophic. The problem with nuclear failures is that you can have accidents that are not related to radiation, and they are similar to those that occur in other kinds of power plants or machinery. But if you do have a radiation-related incident, then it becomes catastrophic, and public perception is very hard to overcome this kind of fear. It's basically fear. Now, people have said that Malaysia has third world maintenance culture. I have mentioned at different fora that I've been including on anti-nuclear that I believe that Malaysian engineers, technical personnel are competent and can be upgraded to perform credibly and commendably at any technology level, provided they are allowed to do so under the competence standards. So long as we do not have any sort of a political intervention on issues, then competence is there. And I think our mass and re-maintenance has shown that.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when you're talking about maintenance culture, I mean, that's, you ask the man on the street and, you know, you're talking about maintaining a nuclear power plant, the first reaction will be quite simply, whoa, we can barely maintain our toilets, let alone a nuclear power plant.
Yeah, that is pretty much the consensus, certainly from our listeners anyway.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, if I can add to that, if you look at India, if you've been to India, you would consider that their maintenance is much, much worse than us.
So are we saying that if India can do it?
Yes, precisely. Because there is a different regime of mindset when you start to run a nuclear power plant. And this is trainable. Good quality maintenance is trainable. And I feel that people should not just brush it aside. So we cannot do that. We have been maintaining all our fleets of aeroplanes, for instance. How do we do that if we do not have the capacity and capability of maintenance? The maintenance culture is there. So to me, it is a matter of appropriate training and regimentation, because we have that capacity to do so. And I'm quite certain what Lau Chan said, that we can do it, and I'm sure we can. I know we can.
We're going to continue our discussion on nuclear energy with Tan Sri Dr. Haji Ahmad Zaidi Laidin, as well as Lau Chan Gulabrai, both Fellows of Academy of Science Malaysia. It's BFM 89.9. It's the evening edition. You're with Caroline and Ezra, and this evening we're speaking about nuclear energy. In the studio with us is Tan Sri Dr. Haji Ahmad Zaidi Laidin, as well as Lau Chan Gulabrai, both are Fellows of Academy of Science Malaysia.
Okay, so in 2010, this we know, the government announced its plans to include nuclear power in our future energy mix. So tell us, why does Malaysia need nuclear power?
Okay, my views may be a little bit awkward and not politically correct.
Fantastic.
Those are the views we love. Go on.
Because first of all, we need to determine what is Malaysia's need for power generation, the demand by the consumers, and how that can be managed. Because power supply and demand have to balance with sufficient reserve capacity to make sure that the supply is adequate, reliable, and hopefully affordable for the users. Projections on power demand are usually based tied to the GDP growth. And GDP growth for Malaysia has been quite healthy. In the past, our power demand growth has been higher than GDP, which actually leads to Malaysia being less energy efficient in many ways compared to our neighbours. But this has now changed a little bit, partly because of institutional features in terms of economic development, partly because of adoption of energy efficiency initiatives. Now, I'm a passionate supporter of energy efficiency, and at the same ETP in 2010, energy efficiency was under the same lab of oil, gas and energy, EPP9, nuclear was EPP11, solar was EPP10. Sadly, in my opinion at least, the integrated resource planning has not been appropriately applied to determine what Malaysia's demand and supply situation should be going 10, 15, 25 years from now.
How was it done?
It is done by agencies that project GDP growth and the demand growth related to the intensity, what's called energy intensity or elasticity. This is generally done by the regulator, that's the Energy Commission. They have formulated this and incorporated in their energy outlooks for 2013, 2014 is the latest one. But in my opinion at least, perhaps I'm biased, there's very little emphasis given in terms of energy efficiency. Now, I'm a little bit, like I said, politically incorrect to say that EPP9, which is considered the lowest of the low-hanging fruits in energy savings, has not been pursued by the agencies concerned as much as EPP11 for nuclear. Why can't we do energy efficiency to reduce the demand for power demand? Whether it is supplied by nuclear, coal or others is immaterial. The question is, by reducing our demand, the consumers do not have to pay for the energy for the later, and this reduction in costs, operating costs, helps them to be internationally more competitive.
Lajan, how would you have then restructured it so that we are more energy efficient?
Okay, I had the opportunity of leading the Institution of Engineers position paper on energy efficiency. This was presented to the ministry in 2009. And at that time, we had forecast that with energy efficiency over a 10-year period, we could save something like 800 megawatts of demand. Now, 800 megawatts of demand coupled with the reserve margin means like 1,000 megawatts of less power generation equipment required. The ministry has recently means about half a decade ago, had consultancies on energy efficiency, which forecast that we could reduce the power generation capacity requirement by over 2,000 megawatts by energy efficiency in a 10-year period. Now, the public funds cost for that exercise would be only about 10% of the cost of the nuclear power plant. So why do we not spend 10% and get the benefits rather than spending 100 times that or 10 times as much and then still having consumers to pay for the electricity? So this is perhaps a little bit radical in the sense that energy efficiency is very critical, and energy efficiency has been adopted by most developed countries and even developing countries as one of the key forms of energy security for their future.
Well, can I add? I do not agree entirely with
fantastic. Good old friends, but disagree.
Go for it.
Because the reason is this. We have been talking about nuclear, not just recently, not just for the future, but as early as 1974, Malaysia, under National Electricity Board. And I was involved in it in the sense that I was sent to Karlsruhe. They have got the IAEA training center there, where the objective was to see how to plan for a nuclear power plant. The concept then was to see how nuclear power plant can help developing countries, not developed countries. So there were about 20-odd developing countries that were invited to Karlsruhe in Germany in order to learn and study about how nuclear can contribute to the whole nation. Now, I agree with Lau Chan regarding energy efficiency, but I also would like to mention to him that things are going on at the moment in most universities. For instance, we are looking at making sure that we save as much energy we can. We also use renewables. We put in solar cells on our rooftops and wherever we could. In other words, we are trying, and we have got energy efficiency people to look at how it can be used more economically. So to me, there is a potential, perhaps more initiatives that are required by government in terms of other forms of incentives. But there is also a lot of things that we ourselves can do, even in our own houses, to save electricity, to reduce, to change the bulbs to be more efficient, for instance, to make sure that you buy electrical equipment that is more efficient because they've got the green rating and so on. So this consciousness is important for all of us. So energy efficiency is not just about government giving incentives, etc., but it's also about individuals who know that they have to reduce expenditure on spending on electricity. So I think things are happening, but I also feel that there is a need for the nuclear power plant. Now, in 1974, when I mentioned just now, when I came back, I put up a proposal to National Electricity Board, and unfortunately, at that particular point in time, we discovered oil and gas. So once we got gas, and we were told at that time there's a lot of gas, so the urgency for having a nuclear power plant was not there. But Philippines was ahead of us. Unfortunately, they chose a site which is supposed to be on a fault line and they had problems in getting, when there is a regime change, that it was mothballed. So their nuclear power plant didn't take off. But they have trained a lot of people. So have we. So as a matter of fact, you might not realize that, but the people whom we trained in 1970s are now holding very key positions here. Tan Sri Tajuddin Ali, for instance, is one of those that was trained in nuclear power plant. And Dr. Zamzam is also another one. And those people now are heading these power units, are looking and studying the possibility of going to nuclear.
It's interesting because both countries almost have had false starts on both of these fronts.
Yeah.
We're going to continue our discussion about nuclear energy with Tan Sri Dr. Haji Ahmad Zaidi Laidin as well as Lal Chan Gulabrai, both our fellows of Academy of Science Malaysia. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. It's the evening edition. You're with Caroline and Ezra in the studio with us. We're speaking about nuclear energy. It's Tan Sri Dr. Haji Ahmad Zaidi Laidin, as well as Lal Chan Gulabrai, both are fellows of Academy Science Malaysia. Let's talk a little bit about safety, and maybe you can talk us through the different scenarios that could arise.
Well, I think we mentioned earlier on about Fukushima. And the disaster in Fukushima is not about the technology side, but it is about the seawall. Unfortunately, they decided on a seawall that was only about 5.4 meters high, when the tsunami was about 10.4 meters. So what happened was that the tsunami, the water came up that high, it just jumped over the wall. And although they put the standby sets the plants on a hill, it was not high enough because the water hit into these temporary gen sets. And because of that, the gen sets could not be started. So that was actually, in a sense, first of all, there's an oversight perhaps of the designers of the civil side, which is actually anticipating that the tsunami can be that high.
Yeah.
And so, but not so much as the operational side. However, the disaster did occur. Nevertheless, and of course, once it did, so to me, to some extent, these sort of disasters are lessons for the future. It may be costly, it may be, you know, very dramatic, but it means that we now know what other things that we can do or should not do later on. So I'm actually very much for this kind of idea that things after so much experience in nuclear that we can continue to go into small power, into small countries, in other words, that can actually have nuclear power plants.
Is it reasonable to ask what causes a meltdown? I mean, how do you determine that?
Well, basically, the meltdown in this case, you have to have energy to run down because you have to bring pump the water and so on to cool. But once the water is not being pumped up because you have no power, then it isn't overheated. You're having a situation where there is an overheating in the reactor. And that is what is considered the meltdown, because the temperature goes up and up and higher and higher. And I think this is what happened, unfortunately, in Fukushima. And then you have got, it takes just a little spark to start an explosion, because you're also generating hydrogen and so on. And this is what happened again. Mm. So to me, even in the case of Chernobyl, you find it was the explosions, subsequent explosions, that actually triggered more and more, disasters from a small problem.
And what kind of progress have we made by way of safety from these lessons that we've learned over time?
I think the safety, as far as the safety measures are concerned, I can see that from every accident that had happened, whether it's the Three Mile Island or the other, they have now instituted stricter control and regime decision making. Sometimes it's purely a decision making. I was told that in the case of Fukushima, for instance, the SOP demanded that you should inform the number one in the country. Unfortunately, there was a delay in reaching the number one. Now, is it necessary when you have a dangerous situation to have to report to the number one? I mean, you may want to report, but to get him to say, yes, you can do,
right,
is a disaster. Right. So this particular simple, perhaps, what do you call it, problem, had now been studied all over the world and made sure that your SOP, if you have a meltdown potential situation, don't try to lengthen the decision-making process to go to,
It just seems like something that is so simple when we're talking about something that is so sophisticated, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Sure. Lal, tell us, a lot of the controversy and arguments about nuclear is centered around waste and how we deal with it. And so what is nuclear waste and how should we deal with it?
Well, nuclear waste is an ongoing issue, because until now, even the first nuclear power plants have not had their waste managed properly. This, I think, is the biggest concern most people have. By the way, I must say this. I'm not anti-nuclear. I believe that in future, there may be maybe 15 years, 20 years from now, Malaysia and other countries will have to go for nuclear because other resources are declining. So there's no question of being completely anti-nuclear. The question is design. For example, Fukushima was designed to accommodate earthquakes of up to 8.2 magnitude. But this one was worse, and the tsunami was worse. Mm. So you can design something to a certain level, but if Mother Nature decides something else, then you go kaboom. But we can design. Human beings, engineers can design to higher levels. And every incident that has occurred has resulted in enhanced safety features. I think just a few days ago, it was announced that Japan has spent over $100 million in enhanced safety features on the nuclear power plants that they want to restart. They haven't started yet, but they've already spent this money. So it enhances safety. Like I said at the beginning, I'm not so concerned about the competence of Malaysian personnel to be able to manage this. They can be trained, and I have said all along, training, research, development, capacity building should continue, both in the government agencies, licensing boards and others that are going to be responsible for regulating the industry, as well as the utilities that are going to run it. Now, obviously, most likely, Tenaga Nasional will have to run the nuclear power plant in Malaysia. And I would like to mention here, Tenaga Nasional has had a record of being the first utility in the world to have gas turbines that have operated 200,000 equivalent hours. And this was advertised not by Tenaga itself, but by the manufacturers of the turbines. Mm. So this is a proof of competence in that respect. Now, as far as issues are concerned on costs, I think the cost issue is still a major issue. Safety is a perception issue, but cost is a real issue. Power plants, nuclear power plants that were started in the 70s and 80s, a lot were stopped because of the cost overruns. And I think the worst case is the one in Finland, which has had cost and time overruns.
All right. So can we just bring it back to waste for a minute? Earlier you said waste is still not managed very well. Where exactly does it go and what does that mean?
It is at the moment being put in containers, which hopefully are supposed to last hundreds of years, and put underground in so-called safety caverns. I think Switzerland, the Yucca Mountains in the United States is a very clear case, which is now a controversy in the United States. And the most recent that I heard was that a lot of this waste is going to be encapsulated in glass or quartz so that it is protected. Now, protected for how long? This is a question that everybody raises. People's concern is not for something that lasts 100 years, 200 years, but thousands of years. And I think the most recent I heard is that it could even go up to a million years. No civilization or authority has lasted long enough to see what that can do. But although there is a lot of talk of managing waste, I have not come across anything that is still comfortable for everybody's perception on safety.
Well, my contention is this, that at the moment, international law demands that all such wastes are kept within the country. In other words, each country has to have its own repository for this nuclear waste. However, the actual technology that is now operating, when we talk about enriched uranium and so on, you're reducing the volume of that waste. Now, there has been talk internationally about even storing all this waste. And if some countries like Australia were to have part of its desert and say, okay, this is solely for the world's waste. If you want to put your waste here, we'll charge you for it. And it is desolate enough, sufficiently, you know, and it is a potential source of revenue for the country. So I think it is not an insoluble question. I think it is something that can be addressed. And the volume is not as much as what we'd have liked. And France, for instance, has got, what, 80% of its energy comes from nuclear power? Now, they have a repository for their waste, and they classify waste in the various countries. And there has not been so far any sort of danger or accidents coming out from that. And I have visited some of this waste in Sweden, for instance, where they, as Lal Chan said, stored it underground, and it was quite safe. I've been right down, you know, underground to see this, and they have this kind of salt. What call? It is salt because it is supposed to be very safe, and of course they look at a place where you do not have tremors and so on. And to me, it can be stored up and 1,000 years or so, maybe more than that. I think there's been sufficient amount of accumulated knowledge to ensure its safety.
So speaking of 1,000 years, let's, you know, wrap up on talk about the future. And, you know, what is Malaysia's promise when it comes to being a nuclear power producer? Are we optimistic about that?
I am. No, I feel that it is intermediate before you find fusion, before you find other technology that can be more, you know, less dangerous perhaps. But in the meantime, unfortunately, as things go up, nuclear should be one of your technology. And as I said again, don't just think about nuclear per se, but the spin-offs around nuclear. Thank you.
I think that is correct, because when Tan Sri mentions unfortunately we found gas, I think it's the other way around. It's fortunately we found gas. But we have to consider all of the above options and not rule out any viable options that can ensure adequate, secure energy supply for national economic development for the long term.
Well, that was Nuclear Power 101, folks. You know, if you missed any part of this program, download the podcast at www.bfm.my. In the studio has been Tan Sri, Dr. Haji Ahmad Zaidi Laidin, as well as Lal Chan Gulabrai, both are fellows of Academy Science Malaysia. It's the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.